You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of The Light Course by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 4, given in Stuttgart on December 26, 1919. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten far enough along with putting together the materials for the experiments. Therefore, tomorrow we will do some things that we wanted to do today, and I will have to adapt today's lecture so that I still present something that will be useful to us in the coming days, with only a slight change in my intentions, more or less. First, I would simply like to describe what could be called the archetypal phenomenon of the theory of color. It will then be a matter of seeing this archetypal phenomenon gradually confirmed in the phenomena you can observe over the entire range of so-called optics or color theory. Of course, the phenomena become more complex, and the simple phenomenon doesn't immediately reveal itself so easily everywhere. However, if we make the effort, we will find it everywhere. This simple phenomenon, stated initially in the Goethean way, is as follows. If we see something brighter through darkness, then the brightness will tend toward the bright colors, in other words, toward yellows or reds. If, for example, I see any shining, so-called whitish-appearing light through a sufficiently thick sheet of glass that has been darkened somehow, then what I see as whitish when I look at it directly now appears to be yellowish, reddish-yellow, figure 4a. Brightness seen through darkness appears yellow or reddish-yellow. That is one pole. Conversely, if you simply have a black surface here and you look at it directly, then you just see the black surface. Let's assume, however, that I have a trough of water here and I shoot light through it so that it is illuminated. Then I have an illuminated liquid here, and I see the darkness through the brightness. I see it through something illuminated. Then blue or violet, purple, appears. In other words, the other pole of color, figure 4b. That is the archetypal phenomenon. Brightness through darkness, yellow. Darkness through brightness, blue. This simple phenomenon can be seen everywhere if we just get used to thinking concretely instead of abstractly, the way modern science thinks. With this in mind, recall the experiment we already conducted, where we let a beam of light pass through a prism and thereby got a true spectrum of colors from violet to red, which we captured. I have already sketched this phenomenon out for you, figure 2c. We were able to say that if we have the prism here and the beam of light here, the light somehow passes through the prism and is diverted upward. And we also said that it wasn't just being diverted. A diversion would take place if a transparent object with parallel surfaces were placed in the path of the light. But a prism with surfaces that meet is placed in the path of the light, and we get a darkening of the light in its passage through the prism. Thus, at the moment we shoot the light through the prism, we are dealing with two different things: the simple bright light that is radiating forth, and the darkness that has been placed in its path. However, this darkness, we said, is placed in the path of the light in such a manner that while the light is diverted, for the most part, upward, what emerges in the form of darkness by radiating upward will have its rays in the same direction as the diversion. In other words, darkness radiates into the diverted light. Darkness lives, so to speak, in the diverted light. In this way, the blues and violets arise. However, the darkness also radiates downward. While the beam of light is diverted this way, upward, Here the darkness radiates downward, but it is acting in opposition to the diverted light and is no match for it. Thus we can say that the diverted bright light drowns out the darkness, and we get yellows or reddish-yellow colors. If we take a sufficiently narrow beam of light, then by looking in the direction of this beam, we can look with our eyes right through the prism. Rather than looking from the outside at the image thrown upon the screen, we can put our eye in the place of this image. If we then look through the prism, the opening that creates the beam of light will appear displaced to us, figure 4C. If we stick with the facts, once again, we have here the phenomenon right before us. If I look in this direction, what would otherwise come directly to me is displaced downward because of the prism. Besides, I see it in color. Everywhere you see it in color. What are you actually seeing? If you can imagine what you see here and state what you are seeing purely in the context of what we have just established, then what you are actually seeing will immediately make sense to you, even in the details. All you have to do is stick with what you see. Isn't it true that if you look at the beam of light this way, you see something bright, because the beam of light is coming toward you? But you see the brightness through darkness, through the blue color, brightness through darkness. Therefore, here you have to see yellow or reddish-yellow. Isn't the fact that blue emerges here clear proof that you have something darkened up here? Down here, the red color proves the same thing, that you have something illuminated. As I already explained, the brightness drowns out the darkness. So by looking here, you see the beam of light, however bright it may be, through something illuminated. Compared with the illuminated object, the beam is something dark. So you are seeing a dark object through a bright object, and you have to see it as blue or purple at the bottom. You simply have to state the phenomenon, and then you already have what you can see. What presents itself to the eye is what else you see here, the blue that you are looking through. Thus the brightness appears reddish. On the lower edge you have an illuminated area. However bright the beam of light may be, you see it through an illuminated object. So you are seeing a darker object through an illuminated object, and it appears blue. That is what it comes down to, polar opposites. If we want to be scholarly, we can call the first experiment on the screen the objective spectrum. The second one, what we see when we look through the prism, we can call the subjective spectrum. The subjective spectrum appears as the inversion of the objective spectrum. If we say it like that, we are speaking like true scholars. People have speculated a great deal about these phenomena, particularly in the modern era. Not only have they observed the phenomena and described them clearly, as we have tried to do now, but they have also speculated about these things, and the most extreme speculation was attempted when the famous Newton thought about light, because the color spectrum presented itself to him first. Of course, Newton made it relatively easy for himself with his so-called explanation, which is all it's ever been. He said that if we have a prism and let white light in, the light already contains the colors. The prism lures them out, and then they march out in order. We simply split up the white light. Then Newton had the idea that a particular substance corresponds to a type of color, so that seven color substances are contained in the whole thing. For him, the passing of light through the prism is a sort of chemical dissection of light into seven individual substances. He even had ideas about which substances emit larger particles, little spheres, and which emit smaller ones. According to this idea, the sun sends us light. We let the light in through the circular opening, and it strikes here, prism, as a beam of light. However, this light consists entirely of little particles, tiny little bodies, which hit here, are diverted from their direction, and then bombard the screen. The little cannonballs strike here, prism. The little ones fly up, the big ones fly down. The little ones are violet, and the big ones are red. Don't you see? Thus do the big ones separate themselves from the little ones. Other physicists, Huygens, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Huygens, maybe Huygens, and Young and others, very soon cast doubt on this view that a substance or various substances are flying around the world. Finally, they arrived at the conclusion that it just can't work that way. These tiny spheres being emitted from some place and simply driven or not driven through a medium, then either arriving at a screen and producing an image or reaching the eye and evoking in us the appearance of red and so forth, it just can't work that way. And people were finally driven to prove this. This whole way of looking at things was upset particularly by an experiment carried out by Fresnel, which had already been prepared by the Jesuit Grimaldi, and also by others. Fresnel's experiments are extraordinarily interesting. We have to get a clear understanding of what actually happens in the way Fresnel set up his experiments. I ask you to pay very close attention to the facts, because it's a matter of studying a phenomenon exactly. Let's assume that I have two mirrors and a source of light here. In other words, I shine light from a flame at this point, so that by setting up a screen here, I get images from this mirror and images from the other mirror, figure 4D. Let's also assume, I'll draw it in cross-section, that the two mirrors are very slightly angled toward each other. Here I have a light source, I'll call it L, and a screen. Thus the light is reflected by striking here, mirror, so that I am able to illuminate the screen with the reflected light. If I allow the light to strike here, then with the mirror I can illuminate the screen here, so that it is brighter here in the middle than in the surrounding area. Now, however, I have a second mirror here, which reflects the light somewhat differently, and a part of what is directed at the screen from my beam of light here below will fall on the upper image. Because of the angle, more or less, the light that the upper mirror reflects is projected onto the screen, as well as that which is reflected by the lower mirror. It is as if the screen were being illuminated from two different places. Let's say that a physicist who thinks in a Newtonian term sees this. He would say to himself, "There's the light source. First, it bombards the first mirror, which hurls its little spheres this way. They bounce off, arrive at the screen, and light it up. But the little spheres also bounce off the lower mirror. A lot of little spheres arrive from there. If there are two mirrors, it must be much brighter than if there were just the one mirror. If I arrange things in such a way that I take away the second mirror, then the screen would have to be illuminated less by the projected light than when I have two mirrors. Mind you, a really awkward thought could occur to this physicist, for these particles, these little bodies, have to go this way just as the others are coming down. Why the ones that are coming down don't bump into them at all and knock them away is extraordinarily difficult to understand. In our physics books, you can find really very lovely stories about wave theory. However, while things are very nicely calculated, you always have to think that they never calculated how such a wave zips through another one. It always goes completely unnoticed. Let's try to understand just for once what really happens here. Certainly the light falls down here, is projected over here, falls onto the second mirror too, and is projected over here. Thus, the light goes to the mirror and is projected over here. That's always the way of light. But what actually happens? Now let's assume we have a stream of light like this one, and it's projected across here. But now here comes the other stream of light and collides with it. The phenomenon can't be denied. They disturb each other mutually. That one wants to zip through there, the other one gets in its way. The consequence of this is that if that one wants to zip through there, it first extinguishes the light coming from there. Because of this, however, we don't get brightness here, the screen, at all. Instead, in actuality, darkness is reflected across here, so that we get darkness here, figure 4E. Now, however, all of this is not at rest. It's in continual movement. What has been disturbed here continues. It's as if a hole has arisen in the light. The hole appears dark. But because of it, the next body of light will pass through all the more easily, and next to the darkness you will have a spot that is brighter. This continues, and once again a little beam of light from above collides with a stream of brightness and extinguishes it, calling forth darkness once again. We are dealing with a continual lattice. The light coming from above can always get through, and by extinguishing the brightness brings darkness once again, which itself continues, however. Thus here we have to get alternating brightness and darkness, because the upper light passes through the lower light and makes a lattice. I have asked you to consider this because you have to look into how a lattice emerges. You have alternating bright spots and dark spots, because light is zipping into light. When light zips into light, then the light is simply cancelled. The light is transformed into darkness. We have to explain the emergence of such a lattice of light based on the arrangement we have made with these mirrors. The speed of light, indeed any differences in the speed of light that occur here, are of no great significance. What I want to show is that what happens here, inside the light itself, with the aid of the apparatus, is that the lattice is reflected here on the screen, light, dark, light, dark. But Fresnel thought that, if light is the emission of particles, then it is self-evident that when more particles are emitted, it has to become brighter. Otherwise, one particle must have eaten up the other. Thus, the fact that brightness and darkness alternate can't be explained according to the emission theory alone. We have just seen how it can be explained, but you see once again that it didn't occur to the physicists to take the phenomenon for what it actually must be. Instead, they attempted an explanation in the spirit of materialism by connecting it to certain other phenomena. The bombardment of little spheres of matter no longer worked. Therefore, they said, let's assume that light isn't the emission of fine substances, but only a movement in a fine substance, in the ether. Movement in the ether. Close quote. And first they had the idea, Euler for example, that light is propagated in this ether more or less as sound is in the air. If I produce a sound, of course, it's propagated through the air, but in such a way that at first the air, in the area surrounding where the sound is produced, is squeezed together, thereby creating compressed air. This compressed air presses in turn on its surroundings. It expands, sporadically causing a rarefied layer of air directly in its vicinity. Through this compression and expansion, which are called waves, we imagine the transmission of sound. And thus they assume that waves of this kind are produced in the ether. However, the idea didn't fit in with certain phenomena. So they said that light was certainly a wave movement, but that it doesn't vibrate the way sound does. In the case of sound, there is compression here, then expansion, and it progresses in the same way. Those are longitudinal waves. Thus, expansion follows compression, and a body moves within it back and forth in the direction of propagation. With light, they couldn't imagine this in the same way. There it must be the case that when light is propagated, the ether particles move vertically to the direction of propagation. Thus, when what we call a ray of light zips through the air, such a ray zips along at a speed of 300,000 kilometers a second, the little particles always vibrate vertically to the direction in which the light is propagated. When these vibrations reach our eye, we perceive them. If we apply that to Fresnel's experiment, then the movement of light is actually a vibration perpendicular to the direction in which the light is propagated. This ray, going to the lower mirror, would vibrate this way, continue like this, and strike here. Now, as I said, they overlook the fact that these series of waves pass through each other. According to physicists who think like this, the waves don't interfere with each other. But here at the screen they interfere with each other right away, or they can also reinforce each other. For what should happen here now? Isn't it true that when this series of waves arrives here, it can be the case that one tiny particle vibrating vertically vibrates downward at the same time that another vibrates upward? Then they cancel each other, and darkness would have to result. If, however, one particle here is vibrating downward just as the other is vibrating downward, or vibrating upward when the other is vibrating upward, then brightness would have to result. Thus they explain, on the basis of vibrations of the smallest particles, the same thing that we explained based on the light itself. The so-called wave theory explains the alternating bright and dark spots here by saying that light is a vibration of the ether. If the smallest particles vibrate such that they reinforce each other, a brighter spot results. If they vibrate in opposite directions, a darker spot results. Now, you have only to consider the difference between the pure perception of the phenomena, remaining within the phenomena and investigating and describing them, and simply making something up about the phenomena. The movement of the ether is, after all, a pure invention. Of course, we can make calculations about something like this, which we have made up, but the fact that we can make calculations about it is no proof that the thing is there. The purely kinematic is something purely imaginary, and calculations are also imaginary. You can see that according to the tenets of our way of thinking, we have to rely on explaining phenomena in such a way that they themselves yield their own explanation, that they hold their explanation within themselves. And I can't emphasize this too much, that everything that is mere musing has to be rejected. You can explain anything by adding something that nobody knows anything about. These waves, for example, could be there naturally, and it could be that if one vibrates downward and the other upward, they cancel each other then, but we made them up. However, what is there, without a doubt, is this lattice, and we see it faithfully reflected here. You do have to look at the light if you want to arrive at an explanation that isn't counterfeited. Now, I told you that if one light passes through another, or comes into any kind of contact with it at all, then under certain circumstances, one light acts to darken the other light, to extinguish it, just as the prism itself acted to darken the light. That becomes especially clear if we do the following experiment. I'll try to sketch out what it's about. Let's assume that we have what I showed you yesterday, a spectrum from violet to red. We actually have such a spectrum, produced, in fact, directly by the sun. Instead of producing such a spectrum by allowing the sun to shine through such an opening, we could also produce it by placing a solid body here that we cause to glow, figure 4F. Then, as it becomes white hot, we gradually have the possibility of getting such a spectrum. It is of no consequence whether we have a sunlight spectrum or one that comes from a white-hot body. Now, however, we can also produce a spectrum in a somewhat modified way. Let's say we have a prism here, and we have a sodium flame here, in other words, a volatile metal, sodium. The sodium turns into gas, which burns and volatilizes, and we produce a spectrum from the volatilizing sodium, figure 4G. Then something quite peculiar happens. If we produce the spectrum not from the sun or from a glowing solid, but from a glowing gas, then a single part of the spectrum is very strongly pronounced. In fact, sodium light tends especially to yellow. Here we have red, orange, and yellow. The yellow part is particularly strongly pronounced in sodium. The rest of the spectrum is atrophied, hardly even present in the metal sodium. Therefore, we apparently get a narrow yellow strip. We call it a yellow band. This happens because it is part of a whole spectrum. The rest of the spectrum is just atrophied. Thus, with all different kinds of bodies, we can find such spectra that aren't really spectra at all, just shining bands. From this you can conclude, conversely, that if you don't know what is actually in the flame and you create a yellow spectrum with it, then there must be sodium in the flame. You can recognize which metal you are dealing with. An odd thing happens, however, if you combine these two experiments, figure 4H. We produce the beam of light here and the spectrum here, and at the same time we put the sodium flame in so that the glowing sodium unites with the beam of light. What happens there is quite similar to what I showed you a little while ago with Fresnel's experiment. We could expect that the yellow here would appear especially strong because there is already yellow in the beam, and then the yellow from the sodium is added to it. But that's not the case. Instead, the yellow from the sodium extinguishes the other yellow, and a dark spot is created. Thus, where we would expect a brighter area to emerge, a dark spot emerges. How could that be? It depends solely on the force that is generated. Let's assume that the sodium light created here was so selfless that it simply allowed the related yellow light to pass through it. Then it would have to extinguish itself completely. It doesn't do that, though. Instead, it blocks the way at exactly the point where the yellow should cross. It is there. Although it is yellow, it doesn't act to strengthen. Instead, it acts to extinguish, because as a force it simply blocks the way, regardless of whether the thing that comes into its path is something else or not. That's of no importance. The yellow part of the spectrum is extinguished, and a black spot is created. From this you can see that, once again, you only need to consider what is there. The flood of light itself offers you the explanation. That's exactly what I would like to point out to you. You see, the physicist who explains things in the spirit of Newton would naturally have to say that if you have something white here, a strip of white, for example, and look at this shining strip, then it appears to you that you're getting a spectrum: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, dark blue, violet, figure 4I. Now, you see, Goethe would say, quote, "Sure, at a pinch, that's all right. If nature really is such that it put light together, then we could assume, of course, that this light is really dissected into its parts by the prism. Wonderful." But the very same people who say that light consists of its seven parts assert at the same time that darkness is nothing at all but the absence of light. Fine. But if I leave a strip of black here between the white and look through the prism, then I also get a rainbow, only with its colors in a different arrangement. Now it's violet in the middle and becomes bluish-green toward one side. Here I get a band that is arranged differently, but in the spirit of the dissection theory, I would have to say that the black could be broken down too. Thus I would have to admit that darkness isn't merely the absence of light. Black would have to be divisible too. However, it would also have to consist of seven colors. Close quote. That's what made Goethe lose his faith. He also saw the black strip in seven colors, only in a different arrangement. This is what forces us once again simply to take the phenomena as they are. Now, we'll have to see to it that tomorrow at 11:30 we're able to demonstrate what I unfortunately could only explain theoretically today. The end of Lecture 4.